last week in 1 Samuel chapter 11, we saw Saul coming into his own as Israel's first king, defeating the Ammonite invaders and saving the Israelite city of Jabesh-Gilead. And then to top it all off, he refused the opportunity to take revenge on the men who had despised him and rejected him as king, and gave the glory to God for the deliverance that had just been effected through his military leadership, making the statement in verse 13, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has worked salvation in Israel." Now, if Saul had suffered a brain aneurysm and died on the spot at the end of this verse, he would be remembered as one of the heroes of the faith, like so many others of Israel's judges and prophets. Because this turns out to be the high watermark of his life. It didn't have to be that way. This is a man whom, as we have noted, started out so good in so many ways. The first person and one of the only people in the Old Testament who is stated to have received a new heart from God, maybe the only person, who had the Spirit rush on him, who made really good choices starting out, who had humility and the fear of God. Now you fast forward to the end of his life, and you find him doing the most atrocious things, instigating the murder of an entire village full of priests simply because he thought that they were harboring David, trying to kill David, his most faithful servant, trying to kill his own son, eventually seeking counsel from a witch and dying by his own hand. No one imagines their life is going to end this way. No one gets up in the morning as a follower of Christ and thinks, "I'm going to go sliding off the path and end my life in sin and unbelief and hard-heartedness." So what happens? What goes wrong? We're going to try to answer that question through studying Saul's life. But there's an interlude here that frames the question in a little bit of a different way by taking the focus temporarily off of Saul and putting it onto someone else, namely the man whose name this book bears, and that is Samuel. So from the end of chapter 11, which is where we're going to start, through chapter 12, we see Samuel giving his farewell address at Saul's second coronation to the men of Israel. And what I want to look at through this passage is this question: what does it take to finish well? Because you know, most people don't. Even many of the Old Testament characters didn't. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 8, Solomon makes an interesting statement. I'm just going to go ahead and attribute Ecclesiastes to Solomon. I know there are some people who don't necessarily believe that he wrote it, but I think, although I'm not going to get into it this morning, that the scriptural evidence for him as the author is actually quite strong. So I'm just going to postulate that Solomon is the author. He says this in Ecclesiastes 7 verse 8, "Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit." So I used to be rather puzzled by this statement, as I still am by some things in Ecclesiastes. It's a rather puzzling book. Because, like a lot of other statements in Ecclesiastes, this sounds very morose. Like, why is the end of a thing better than its beginning? I believe that what Solomon is getting at here is sort of unlocked by the parallel statement that he makes. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. I believe what he meant is that the end of a thing is more important. It is of more value. It means more to look at the ending of a thing than its beginning. So when you look at the parallel statement, the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit, what is a proud person focused on? The present, the here, the now, what I know, what I can do, what other people are thinking of me. You cannot be proud of yourself in the future because you don't know what the future holds. And to think about the future actually has a humbling effect. And that is why many proud people do not think about the future very much, or they don't think about it realistically. One of my favorite quotes from Winston Churchill is, "The cemeteries are full of indispensable men." Meaning, there are plenty of people throughout history who have thought themselves very important and very central to events. Guess what? They died, like everyone else, and the world moved on without them. And for a person to be proud, he or she must put that out of their mind and not think about the fact that one day the world will move on without them. In fact, for the vast majority of us, probably within 100 years or a lot less after we die, the world will forget that we even existed. Now, I happen to know the names of my great-grandparents, but I would venture to guess that most of you probably couldn't name every single one of your great-grandparents, which is, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. You take it back another generation, great-great-grandparents, that's, what is that? 4 generations. I could not name all of my great-great-grandparents. The world just doesn't remember us that long. The things that go on in our lives seem very important to us. And there is a sense in which they are important. There is, in fact, a sense even in which we are important because we're important to God. But objectively speaking, we're not that important. And a proud person does not like to think about that. So they tend to be very focused on the present. But you contrast this, and it's interesting to me that Solomon chooses to contrast pride with patience. What is a patient person focused on? A patient person is focused on the future. A patient person is focused on the ending of the thing. Not how it starts out, but how it will end. What that person expects to get in the future. And the greatest patience is shown in being willing to extend that vision and extend that focus on the future beyond the grave itself. And in faith, to put one's hope in the resurrection. And to seek for the rewards that everyone wants in the time and in the place where they will be without end, where we don't have to die and leave them. Another reason that the end of a thing is better than its beginning is that it's the end of a thing that most truly reveals its character. One of the reasons that older people tend to be, are not always, but tend to be wiser than the young is that they are closer to the end of their lives. And being closer to the end of their lives, it is easier for them to say, from that perspective, what things were truly important. They have seen the beginnings of things, and they've seen their endings. And it's quite different. I'm old enough now to have had this experience. I have seen some things start out with great enthusiasm and with a lot of people on board and saying, oh, this is the greatest thing ever, and it's going to change the world. And you go 10 years in the future, and like nobody's even talking about it anymore. Nobody cares. So as you live and you get those experiences, you begin to recognize how to tell if something is truly important or not. What its real character is going to be revealed by how it ends, not by how it started. And most important of all, it is the end of a person's life on earth that reveals what their true relationship with God was. 3 different times in 2 Gospels, Jesus makes this statement, "But the one who endures to the end will be saved." Jesus says something 3 times, you can be sure. It's pretty important. Throughout the epistles, there are similar warnings, many of them anchored in Old Testament stories that teach us a lesson. I've read this before, but I'm going to read a little longer portion from 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul says, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed him, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did." And then Jude chapter 1, it's only 1 chapter in Jude, so Jude verse 5 says, "Now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe." These are just 2 examples. There are many more throughout the New Testament that point to the fact that the beginning of a thing is not necessarily the same as its ending, and you have to look at the end to understand what the beginning really was. What was the character of those who claimed to believe and who claimed to follow when the Israelites came to the edge of the Promised Land, having sung God's praises at the Red Sea? They came to the edge of the Promised Land, saw the giants, and said, "We don't trust you. We want to go back to Egypt." That showed what their faith really was. Not how they started out with such great enthusiasm and praises for God, but whether or not at the end of it all, they were obedient and they were not, and they fell in the wilderness. One of the most striking examples in the Old Testament of this, ironically, is the very man whom I quoted just moments ago, Solomon. Can you imagine having a better start in life than being the son of King David, in the lineage foretold to be that of the Messiah, the builder of God's physical temple, the recipient of a greater wisdom than was ever given to any mortal man other than Jesus Christ himself? Yet he somehow ended his life as a hard-hearted idolater, so far as we know. So what does it take to finish well? Beginning well is not that hard. What does it take to finish well? I want to look at four things today, through the end of chapter 11 of 1 Samuel and throughout chapter 12, that I believe we can see in Samuel's life and apply to our own lives so that we can learn from the example of those that did not finish well, and we ourselves can follow the example of a man like Samuel who did. So beginning in verse 14 of chapter 11, then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and there renew the kingdom." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they sacrificed peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. And Samuel said to all Israel, "Behold, I have obeyed your voice in all that you have said to me, and have made a king over you. And now, behold, the king walks before you, and I am old and gray, and behold, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my youth until this day. Here I am, testifying against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken, or whose donkey have I taken, or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed, or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? Testify against me, and I will restore it to you." They said, "You have not defrauded us, or oppressed us, or taken anything from any man's hand." And he said to them, "The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand." And they said, "He is witness." The first principle that I want to draw from this passage, the first thing that you must do if you want to finish well, is to guard your integrity. What is integrity? The English word comes from a Latin word, integer, which actually comes into English as our word for a whole number. That's what it means. It means whole. A person of integrity is a whole person. That means their life is not divided. There are not separate compartments. One over here for Sunday morning, where I worship God and love him. Another one over here for my work on Monday, where I may have to do a few dishonest things in order to get ahead. Another one over here for my family life, where I just do the minimum in my marriage or with my children. That is a broken person. That is a person divided into parts. A whole person is the same throughout in their character and their nature. Not a person that never sins, but a person who does not divide and segment their life off and being okay with sin here, although over here I act like it's a big problem, especially for other people. Did you know that there's actually only one whole person who's ever lived? We sing this song in church. I love it. It's one of my favorite hymns by Andrew Peterson. Is he worthy? Jason had to correct my lyrics on that because I thought it said, "Is anyone worthy? Is anyone holy?" But it actually says, "Is anyone worthy? Is anyone whole?" And I love to sing that now the way that Andrew wrote it, because there actually is only one who is a whole person. There's only one who was not divided, as was prophetically shown by the garment that he wore, which was without seam. There was nothing divided in the life of Jesus Christ. He was a whole person who was the same in private as he was in public. What he taught was what he did, and what he did was what he taught. There was a consistency throughout his life from his childhood all the way to the cross. He was in line with his Father's will and with his Father's purposes. He is the only one who truly has integrity. A few years ago, Harvard-trained economist named Seth Stevens Davidowitz wrote what would become a very popular book. It's called Everybody Lies. And the premise of this book is that our public selves and our private selves tend to be very different people. How do we know this? Well, the way that he proved it was by accessing data from the one company that for the average person knows them better than anyone else on earth, including their spouse. Who do you think that is? Google. Think about it. What have you searched for in the past week? What does it tell about you? I mean, it's private. Should be, anyway, private, anonymous. Some people search for things and about things they don't even tell their spouse about, or their kids, or their closest friends. But Google knows. And Google knows that in the aggregate, we don't actually care as much about the things we say we care about. We don't actually care as much as we say we do about some things, and we care a lot more than we say we do about other things. This is why he says everybody lies. Because society itself is structured in such a way that honesty is generally not the thing that people prize most highly. It's smooth social interaction. And as a result, we say things that we don't really mean. And we are one way in church on Sunday morning and another way at work on Monday morning in a different way when we're at home on Monday night. But here's the thing. As followers of Christ, we are called to be like him. And he was a whole person. And this is what God wanted from his people. And that is why Jesus said when he saw Nathanael coming to him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit." That's John chapter 1 and verse 47. Jesus was saying that the defining characteristic of an Israelite, or one who is called as part of the covenant people of God, is that there is no deceit in his life. He did not say there is no sin, because no one was without sin except for Jesus Christ. And not one of us will ever be without sin, but we can be without deceit. We do not have to deceive ourselves or others. We do not have to create compartments in our lives. We are the people of the truth, as Jesus said in John 18:37, when Pilate asked him, "So are you a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." We are people of the truth, and we should have nothing to do with deceit, and our lives should be defined by integrity, being the same way in public as we are in private, at church, at work, at home. It all should be manifesting one character, and that is the character of Jesus Christ. Many people start out with integrity and they care about it, but as they grow older, they allow it to slip. The greatest danger to integrity, I believe, is the attainment of power. When you have the power to get what you want, to keep your actions secret, to avoid or silence criticism, you have the perfect recipe to destroy your own integrity while deceiving both yourself and everyone around you into thinking that you are walking with Christ. Now, you might think, well, I don't really have power. I'm not a political office holder or a business owner or something like that. Everyone has some measure of power. And the more you have, even if it's just as a parent or as a husband or whatever it might be, whatever measure of power you have, it is possible, and many people do, to use that to their own advantage and to create an impression. This is what the Pharisees did. They used their position as the religious leaders to project that they were the holy people, that they were the teachers of the law, that they had a close walk with God. And in reality, their lives were full of sin and hypocrisy. You might have everyone fooled. The Pharisees did. But guess who isn't fooled? Galatians 6, verse 6 and 7. "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that will he also reap. For the one who sows to his flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life." Despite the authority that he exercised as Israel's chief, whatever you want to call it, chief executive, chief judge, whatever, for such a long time, Samuel guarded his integrity such that not one person could charge him with a misuse of his authority, which is pretty amazing. That brings us to the second thing that I want to draw your attention to from Samuel's life, the second principle, the second thing you must do if you want to finish well. And that is to seek accountability. Not just be okay with it, not just tolerate it, but seek it out. I very much doubt that it was just now at the end of his career as a judge that Samuel suddenly decided to open the floor and listen to any complaints that anyone might have and restore anything that anyone claimed he had unjustly taken from them. The tendency for those who have held authority and power for a long time is to become less accountable, not more. I believe that Samuel very likely sought out this sort of accountability throughout his service as Israel's judge. He sort of implies that when he says, I have walked before you from my youth until this day. He did not hold himself up above and to a different standard than those over whom he exercised the authority. He walked among them. He let them see his life. There was a transparency to the way he lived. He walked with the people that he served. If there's just one thing you take away from this message today, I hope it is this. You cannot guard your integrity alone. That is not the way it works. Why do soldiers always go into firefights in at least pairs of two? Because you cannot watch your own back. It's not possible. You don't have eyes in the back of your head. It is not possible for you to guard your integrity against every possible threat because there are threats that you will not see. There is one person whom human beings are better at deceiving than anyone else, and that is ourselves. It seems like every month, if not more often, there is some terrible news about some Christian leader who has fallen in some dramatic way and destroyed their testimony and disgraced their ministry and brought disrepute on the name of Christ. What happened? I have to believe they did not seek out accountability. They did not have those in their lives that know what's going on. Every Christian needs at least one person, and preferably more, that knows everything that's going on in their life. And for many of us, that will be our spouse. But for those that are unmarried, it may require some intentionality. But you need someone with whom you can practice James 5, verse 16. Therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working. You see Samuel inviting this sort of accountability, even publicly, because he was a judge. It needed to be public. He said, if I've done anything to anybody, if I've accepted a bribe, if I've taken anything from anyone unjustly, you come and testify against me and I will restore it to you. That is the kind of attitude that we need to have. Find at least one person. Here's an exercise for you. Sit down. Imagine that you are in some sin that you cannot see, that you are blind to, that you are justifying yourself about, and ask yourself, who is there in my life that would come to me and say, I see this and I don't think it's right? And if there isn't someone, then go and find somebody and cultivate that relationship. If there is someone, then for extra credit, find that person sometime this week and sit down with them and say, do you see anything in my life right now that I don't see? Is there anything in my life that is not Christ-like? I want you to be honest with me. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm not going to justify myself. I'm just going to listen to what you say, and then I'm going to go pray about it. So just tell me, what do you see in my life that doesn't look like Jesus Christ? And then do that. Don't argue. Don't justify yourself. Just listen and take it to the Lord and see if there's something that you don't see. Because this is why God put us in each other's lives. And all of us need it. And the more authority a person wields, the more they need it. If we don't want to be one of those that ultimately brings disgrace upon the name of Christ, not only must we guard our own integrity, we must seek accountability so that others can guard it for us and we can do the same for them. Moving on in chapter 12 to verse 6, Samuel said to the people, "The Lord is witness who appointed Moses and Aaron and brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous deeds of the Lord that he performed for you and for your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and the Egyptians oppressed them, your fathers cried out to the Lord, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, and he sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them, and they cried out to the Lord and said, "We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and Ashtaroth. But now deliver us out of the hand of our enemies that we may serve you." And the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Barak and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you lived in safety. And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, "No, but a king shall reign over us," when the Lord your God was your king. And now behold, the king whom you have chosen, for whom you have asked, behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. Now therefore stand still and see this great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest today? I will call upon the Lord that he may send thunder and rain, and you shall know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord in asking for yourselves a king. So Samuel called upon the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. Sometimes I think we can learn as much by what someone doesn't say as what they do say, by what isn't in this passage, what is not in this passage. It's very interesting. Samuel asks the people, "What have I done that's wrong? You bring your charges here against me." And they say, "Nothing. You haven't done anything wrong. You haven't taken bribes. You've done your job. It's great." Now, what would you or I say in that situation? "Then why did you want rid of me? What's the deal? Why are you throwing me out like an old shoe if I haven't done anything wrong and if I've done my job well?" Samuel didn't say that. He immediately pivots from talking about himself to talking about God. Because what does he understand? Again, I know I'm saying this over and over again, but it is so important. Samuel understood that he was not the main character, that it wasn't important what the people thought of him. God had already told them, "They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me." But how hard is it for us not to take it personally and to want to rush to our own defense and vindicate ourselves and care about what people think of us? That's not what Samuel wanted to talk about. Once he has cleared himself, once he has established, there's nothing that anyone holds against me, and I've done my job the way I was supposed to with integrity, he immediately shifts over and says, "Let me talk to you about how you are rejecting your God. Let me recount all the things he has done for you. Not all the things I've done, but the things he has done for you. After all of which, you say, 'No, we don't want God for our king. We want a man like us.'" Verse 11, I love this. He lists out the people that God has used in the past to deliver Israel. And he mentions himself in the third person at the end of the list. He doesn't say, "So the Lord sent..." My Bible pages stuck together, sorry. So he doesn't say that the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Barak and Jephthah and me. He says, "And Samuel," right? He's talking about himself as though he were talking about someone else, because he's not the point. He's just one of the ones who through whom God chose to work. It's the same thing that we find Paul saying to the Corinthians. Like, "Why are you making a big deal out of me or Apollos? It doesn't make any difference. Who's Paul? Who's Apollos?" Just someone that God chose and said, "Here, go do this." And God gave the power and God enabled the service. So it doesn't matter. Samuel did not want people to think that this is about me, this is personal, because you've rejected me as a judge and wanted a king. No, this doesn't matter. The problem is that you've rejected your God. The problem is that you've downgraded your relationship with him. You know, it's kind of interesting. The sign that Samuel asked God to send was rain in a harvest day. And in Proverbs, it says, "As snow in summer and rain in harvest, honor is not seemly for a fool." Now, I don't know that Saul, at least at this point in his life, would be called that. I don't think he would. But what it points to is the unfitness of giving the honor that belongs to God to a man. No matter who that man is, it could be the best man in the world. But if the honor and the glory is going to any human being instead of to God, it is unseemly. It is wrong. And that is what Samuel was discerning in the hearts of the people, was you are looking to give the honor that belongs to God to a human being like yourselves. And that is unseemly. It is foolish. It is wicked, actually. And that is what people are inclined to do because we are idolatrous at heart. But Samuel did something here that is the third thing that I want you to remember, that this is what you must do if you want to finish well. You must stay fixed on God. When people are praising you and saying you're awesome, stay fixed on God. When people are rejecting you and disrespecting you, stay fixed on God. When people are ignoring you and not listening to you and acting like you don't even exist, stay fixed on God. If there is one reason more salient than any other why Saul did not finish well, it's that even though he started out fixed on God, he let it slip. And he became obsessed with the opinions of people. Even after he had already been told that he had lost the kingdom, that God had appointed David to be king after him, he had an opportunity with David as his son-in-law and Jonathan wanting to step out of the way. He could have just said, okay, this is what God has ordained. I'm just going to let this happen. But he couldn't because he was consumed with jealousy. He was consumed with what people thought about him. And to himself, he became the main character. And that was all that mattered. If he had to kill his son, if he had to kill his most faithful servant, if he had to kill a whole village full of priests, he was going to have the good opinion of people. He was going to have his own good opinion of himself. He lost his focus on God. And he forgot what Samuel always remembered, that it doesn't matter what people think of me. It matters what God thinks of me and what people think of God. Those are the two things that matter. And the second thing cannot be neglected. That brings us to the fourth principle, verse 19. What people think of God. All the people said to Samuel, "Pray for your servants to the Lord our God, that we may not die. For we have added to all our sins this evil to ask for ourselves a king." And Samuel said to the people, "Do not be afraid. You have done all this evil. Yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And do not turn aside after empty things that cannot profit or deliver, for they are empty. For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, and I will instruct you in the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king." The fourth and final thing that we learn from the life of Samuel that we must do if we want to finish well is to keep serving to the end. It's easy to imagine that Samuel could have been very bitter, having been rejected in favor of this tall, handsome farmer from Gibeah. He could have just taken his little red wagon and gone home and said, "Okay, now you can eat your own cooking, and I hope you choke on it. You wanted a king, so you've got him, and I'm just going to sit here like Jonah outside Nineveh and wait for your destruction." That was not his attitude. Not necessarily because he loved Israel so much, but because he understood that to fail to continue in his assignment would be a sin against God. Why? Because the assignment came from God in the first place. Again, this ties into the staying fixed on God. If God is the one who has given you a job to do, then it does not matter if someone else says, "We don't want you here anymore." I mean, it may matter in terms of your ability to exercise a direct influence on that person or that group of people, but that doesn't mean that you're released from the responsibility. Samuel said, "I would be sinning against God if I stopped praying for you, and I will continue to teach you. Even though you don't want me for your judge, I will continue to do these things because it is God who told me to do it in the first place." Samuel was commissioned by God and not man. I run into this quite often in talking about marriage. And people are like, "Well, my spouse doesn't love me." I'm like, okay, that's bad. It doesn't mean that you don't have to love them anymore. You took your vow before God. You made the promise to God. God gave the command. He said, "You're to love your spouse." So your spouse doesn't love you anymore, doesn't care about the marriage anymore. You still have to, 100%. This is not it does not depend on reciprocity. You stay fixed on God and you keep doing your job and you pray for that person and you love that person, and you may be surprised about what happens when you are focused on doing what God told you to do instead of that other person or group of people that you may believe are not doing what God told them to do. I do not plan to retire by the grace of God. And before you think that that means that I'm going to be 95 years old, still standing here in the pulpit, not necessarily. Maybe, but not necessarily. I've told several people that my ambition is to, for the last thing I do on this earth, to be to preach the gospel. I would love to come to the end of a gospel sermon and just die on the spot. I think that'd be awesome. But I may not get to do that. I may not be physically able to do that. And if that's the case, I will still not be retired, because I consider that my work is serving God by serving people. And I will, by the grace of God, I will find a way to do that. My brother Jeremy, who most of you know quite well, has Parkinson's disease and is in pain all the time and can't sleep at night. And he's up and he's preaching over the internet to people an ocean away. Mom's sister, oldest sister, is 85 years old. She's almost completely blind. And they got her a special magnifying machine so that she can continue to write letters to those who need encouragement, especially to prisoners. And she still has the most beautiful handwriting I've ever seen. I don't know how that's possible, but I get a Christmas card from her every year. And I'm like, I cannot believe this woman is almost completely blind. They are doing what they can. They are serving where they can. There is no one who is alive and breathing that cannot do the thing that Israel's greatest judge said he was going to do in his retirement, and that is to pray. When I first wrote this in my notes, I said, you can serve even if it's only to pray. And I said, no, I don't want to say that, because that makes it sound like it's the least important or least effective thing that you can do. And in reality, it's the most important and most effective thing that you can do. Samuel spent his life praying for the people. Paul prayed for the churches that he founded. Jesus spent all nights, entire nights in prayer before he called the disciples, and praying for the disciples and praying for the church. Anyone can do this. Even if you have no voice, you're blind and paralyzed and cannot speak in a voice that anyone can hear, God can hear your heart. You can pray. Serve to the end. And if they kick you out, then pray from the parking lot. And if they chase you out of the parking lot, pray from your closet at home. Don't stop. Because it's Christ whom you're serving. If no one else cares or knows or acknowledges, or even they say that you're wrong, and they don't value what you do at all, serve. Because you are hoping, and I am hoping, for the reward that comes from our Master who gave us this assignment. When it comes to finishing well, I always think about running. I don't know how many of you here have ever run or like to run. My wife says that if you ever see her running, you should probably run too. So I know a lot of people don't like running, and I don't do it compulsively. I'm not like some people who got to get up and run every single day. But I have run a 5K one time in my life. I'm going to run another one here in a couple weeks because some friends are coming back from missionaries in Mexico, and their place where they're doing it is within walking distance of my house. And so I'm like, I'd be pretty poor excuse for a friend if I didn't at least show up. Probably not going to have a very good time. But anyway, I mean, not run a very good time. I think I'll enjoy it. But there's something that running coaches, I think, pretty universally tell the athletes that they coach. And I'm talking about, you know, time, not just timed, but actual races where you're racing against other people. And they give them this bit of advice: run through the tape. And what that means is they're referring to the tape that goes across the finish line, and the first runner to break it is, of course, the winner of the race. But the tendency, unconsciously, if you haven't been coached, is when you see the finish line, what do? You start to slow down. And because of that, you could end up losing the race because someone else keeps up their pace. It's interesting that the writer of Hebrews used this analogy as well when he talked about finishing well, about not letting up. So I'm going to turn to Hebrews chapter 12. And this is, of course, the chapter that immediately follows the Hall of Faith. The list of all of the ones that did finish well, and you have been given to us as examples. Actually, not everyone in that's listed in Hebrews 11 did, but they all did have faith, and many of them did finish well. This is what the author of Hebrews says. If you listen carefully, you're going to hear each one of those principles that we've looked at today. Each one of those four is in some form or fashion to be found in this short passage from Hebrews 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So these four things that we must do if we want to finish well. Let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. Guard your integrity. Make the smallest sin your enemy and repentance your lifestyle. Cast away anything in your life that keeps you from running your race well. Imagine that you've trained and you're finally ready to run a marathon for the first time in your life. That's 26 miles. I'm pretty sure I'm never going to do that, but I have great admiration for those who do. And you get halfway through the marathon and somebody runs up to you and says, "Here's a German chocolate cake. Please take this cake." You're like, "I've got 13 more miles to run. I'm not going to run trying to hold a German chocolate cake. I don't care how much you like cake. You're not going to do that. You're not going to take that. You're going to be looking for ways to lighten your load, not increase it. Cast away everything, every weight, the sin which clings so closely. Guard your integrity. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." And this is tying into that idea of seeking accountability, seeking fellowship, because you notice it's in the plural. He says, "Let us run this race with endurance." We run together. I don't happen to have a running partner. I wish I did, because it'd be a lot easier if I did. It gets hard out there sometimes to stay motivated. We run as those who know that every part of our lives will be open to examination at the judgment seat of Christ. So we live in readiness for that examination, willing to let others examine and challenge us along the way. Looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. This one is the most obvious one. Stay fixed on God. Something that I'm pretty sure every runner has probably experienced is the way that your mind can overrule your body for good or for ill. If I'm out there and I'm thinking, I'm going to run 4 miles today. That's the longest I've ever run continuously. I know that's not very much, but it's good for me. I've only done it a couple of times, including last week. I was actually thinking I was going to run 5 miles last week, but I made a mistake. I started thinking about how tired I felt as I was approaching the end of the fourth mile, and I started thinking about, no one is making me do this. Why am I doing this? And before I know it, my body is beginning to flag, because why? I lost sight of my goal. If I had stayed fixed on this one thought, I'm going to run 5 miles today, I'm going to reach that 5 mile marker, I'm sure that I could have made it. I probably could have run further. It is so important to stay fixed on your goal. Your body in running will do things that you don't think that you can, as long as your mind doesn't sabotage it by taking your eyes off the goal. Stay fixed on God, because that's what Jesus did. Who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Serve to the end. What do you find Jesus doing on the cross? Bearing our sin. Because not one of us had integrity, because not one of us was whole, because we were all broken, he took the sin of the whole world on his shoulders and let it crush him. When he hung on the cross, he was serving you and me to his very last breath. Even in the things that he spoke, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." He was giving his life a ransom for you and me. He did not retire. He served his Father and he served mankind to his last breath. So if you want to finish well, guard your integrity, seek accountability, stay fixed on God, and serve to the end. Run through the tape. We have a cloud of witnesses cheering us on. And at that finish line, the one who is standing, who made it all possible for us. So run through that finish line and into his arms.